Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the Palestinian question. It's the one issue that unites the many voices of the Arab world. One expert on the Arab-Israeli conflict says that to understand what Palestine means to Arabs, to Muslims, you need look no further than the Jewish commitment to Israel. First, funding a global terror network with jewels. According to the Washington Post, Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda has been bankrolling its terrorist organization with the illicit sale of diamonds mined by rebels in Sierra Leone. Earlier today, I spoke to Douglas Farah, the Washington Post's West Africa correspondent.
Well, it seems that there have been contacts since at least 1998 between one of the main diamond brokers for the Revolutionary United Front in Sierra Leone and al-Qaeda operatives. A fairly high-level al-Qaeda operative arrived in Monrovia, Liberia, and set up the initial contact, and then sent in two operatives later to sort of continue that work, and they were actually there as late as January of this year. They were identified from the most wanted poster that the Bush administration put out, and that's how they were identified as al-Qaeda operatives.
How did it or does it work? What do diamonds do for al-Qaeda?
Well, they do two things. One, they can buy them quite cheaply from the RUF in Sierra Leone and then sell them at a much greater value on the diamond market, so they can make a lot of money doing that. And since July, what they apparently have been doing is buying up enormous amounts of diamonds with money that they had stashed in other currency on bank accounts and things. The intelligence community assumes that, knowing that their bank accounts would be frozen on after September 11th, they took lots of money out and put it into diamonds, and I imagine a lot of other things as well. But diamonds are especially nice because they're small. You can carry them around easily. You can convert them whenever you want. They don't go bad. They don't lose their value, and they're extremely easy to transport. So in a sense, it's an ideal way to turn your cash into something other than cash, and that's convertible back to cash when you need it.
And for al-Qaeda, then, it's been both a way to make money and, since September 11th, a way to preserve their money and keep it from being among frozen assets.
Exactly, yes. And it's not clear. They asked some of the RUF commanders to double their diamond production starting in July. And since then, diamond production has markedly gone up. Antwerp and Monrovia are awash in Sierra Leonean diamonds, but the prices remain very high, which means someone is paying a premium for a commodity of which there is a lot of on the market, which indicates there's another purpose behind buying it besides the normal profit-making. And the intelligence community assumes this because that's where they wanted to stash funds.
So this may be another example of the forethought and planning that went into the September 11th attacks, even to the extent of covering their cash assets by converting them into diamonds to protect them from being frozen.
Yes, it seems as though they put, you know, several million dollars. I don't know if anyone has a reasonable estimate of what the CADA organization has in terms of assets, but it seems as though they've put several million dollars at least into diamonds.
Doug, describe the connection between this lead diamond broker that you mentioned and al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and the Afghanistan connection.
Well, Ibrahim Ba has been a figure that has been known in the RUF as a senior member of the RUF for quite some time and their main diamond dealer for many years. He turns out to have been a longtime operative in the region, having been trained in Libya. He did religious training in Mauritania and Egypt, and then was trained in Libya in the early 1980s, and then went to Afghanistan as a mujahideen to fight the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. He then went to Hezbollah to join Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Iranian-backed terrorist organization there, and then returned to Libya about the same time that Libya was taking an active interest in training the revolutionary movements in West Africa. So he hooked up with Charles Taylor, who's now president of Liberia. He hooked up with Blaise Compaoré, who's now president of Burkina Faso. He hooked up with Fody Sanko, who was founding the RUF, and set about making their international contacts for them on the financial side especially, and especially for the RUF, where most of the leadership is illiterate and most of the leadership has spent their entire life in the bush. He became the person who could go to the outside world with the diamonds. And one of the things that I found fascinating in this is that the RUF received a fraction of the value of the diamonds that they mine. They send out packets of diamonds without knowing what they're really worth and say, you know, take this packet and then send us 100 bags of rice, when the packet of diamonds may be worth 100 times that. And Ba was able to then build a fortune and finance Taylor, finance Campori, and passed on brokers for Qaeda and Hezbollah as well in this operation.
Do we know if Ibrahim Ba actually knew or knows Osama bin Laden directly, or is this just another example of how the Muslim resistance to the Soviets in Afghanistan became a kind of uniting experience for a generation of Muslim guerrillas?
I think the latter. I'd have no indication that he actually knows bin Laden, but clearly he has kept ties to the Muslim world in that world, and also to Hezbollah. Hezbollah also has a large financial operation in West Africa, and he has also been helping move diamonds for Hezbollah for quite some time. So he apparently kept his battlefield contacts going and was in a position then to help them financially.
Your source for this story was U.S. and European intelligence sources, Doug. What's being done now to shut off this diamond pipeline as a means of support for al-Qaeda?
Frankly, Tom, my main source on this were two people who were directly involved in the operations and knew when we started out, I think, probably a lot more than the intelligence agencies did, although they were able to then help confirm a lot of the information that these individuals provided me. I think right now they're scrambling. I think that some of the names of the brokers were known to them. The Qaeda connection was not confirmed by them until the sources gave me some ways to check that out. So I think right now they're scrambling to figure out how to shut off this pipeline. I don't think that there is, I think certainly the safe house in Monrovia will be looked at and shut down very quickly if it's not already shut down. And I think some of the brokers in Antwerp will be looked for and talked to. But I don't know, it's a very difficult thing to shut down the smuggling of very small stones that you can hide virtually anywhere and are not detectable by dogs or metal detectors or anything. So it's a hard thing to do.
Douglas Farah is West Africa correspondent for The Washington Post. I spoke to him earlier from Sierra Leone. Osama bin Laden has linked the lack of peace in America to the lack of peace in Palestine, and he's just the latest to embrace the plight of the Palestinian people for political gain. Once again, the message resonates because, regardless of the messenger or the motivation, people in the Arab world have come to care deeply, personally, about the Palestinians. Our guest tonight, Shibli Telhami, has been surveying Middle Eastern nations and says the role of the Palestinian issue is more profound than most Americans imagined. In the war on terror, can the U.S. win over the hearts and minds of the Islamic world without dealing head-on with the Palestinian issue? And can it be done without damaging the U.S. relationship with Israel? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Phoenix is Shibli Telhami. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and an expert on the Arab-Israeli conflict. His forthcoming book is Identity and Foreign Policy in the Middle East. Good evening, Shibli Telhami.
Good evening to you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Shibli Telhami, in the United States, we talk about playing the race card. Osama bin Laden appears to be playing the Palestinian card. What's he saying? Why is he saying it? And who is listening? How does it resonate?
There's no question that he's playing the Palestinian card. This is a man who is not a champion of the Palestinian cause. Clearly, his agenda is really to set up an Islamic state in all of the Middle East, in all of the Islamic world. He, in fact, sees secular nationalism as an enemy. He's an enemy of the PLO because he sees them as betraying the Islamic cause. He's an enemy of the Palestinian Authority. He's an enemy of most secular regimes in the Middle East. And yet, it doesn't translate into not caring about the Palestinian issue. Clearly, he has used the Palestinian issue in the past as one of many issues, as an issue that concerns Muslims. And also, he has focused on the issue of Jerusalem, which is clearly important to Muslims. In this particular case, though, he used it as the central theme for his message to the Arab world. He ended his taped message after the operations commenced on Afghanistan with a very dramatic oath linking the absence of peace in America to the absence of peace in Palestine. He uses it for a very simple reason, because his own message, his own real aims do not resonate in the Arab world. But this issue resonates in the Arab and Muslim worlds more than any other single issue.
Shibli Telhami, when Americans look at the Middle East, it doesn't seem so difficult at the surface to see why Palestinians may be upset. But you say that it's a much more profound issue than Americans are fully aware of. Explain that to us.
To me, it is an identity issue. I mean, first of all, I have already surveyed that empirically. I've done a survey in 5 Arab countries. That included the most populous Arab state, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Lebanon. I did a survey last spring and asked people how important the Palestinian issue was to them personally. In all countries but Egypt, nearly 60% of the public ranked this issue as, quote, the single most important issue to them personally. And another 20% ranked it as being in the top 3. In Egypt, the results were even more dramatic. 79% of the public said it's the single most important issue to them. Now, to me, that doesn't mean it's more important than putting food on the table. It doesn't mean it's more important than family issues for them. What it does mean to me is that it is a central issue of identity. And in my mind, over the past half a century, this issue has become a central issue in the collective consciousness of Arabs and Muslims. It reflects their own identity in a similar way that the Israel has become an integral part of contemporary Jewish identity over the past half a century. And there are many reasons for that. Those reasons have to do with the way history of the Arab and Muslim worlds played themselves out in the past half a century, how central this issue has been in the encounter between the Middle East and the West, beginning with the end of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, beginning with the Balfour Declaration that promised Jews a state in Palestine, beginning after World War II with the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, where after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Arab states collectively went to war against that state and lost a dramatic war that has been imprinted in the consciousness of an entire generation.
But Shibli Talami, the Arab identity was not always so sewn up with the Palestinians through many of the events that you've just described. How is it that it sits so much at the heart of that Arab identity today, and why does it sit there? There are so many things that they surely could find as points of identity.
First of all, I don't think there's any other issue that has had that kind of profound importance over the past half a century in terms of real events that affected people's lives, in particular the 1948 defeat, mm-hmm. the 1967 defeat, mm-hmm. the 1973 war, the Camp David negotiations between Egypt and Israel. And in addition to that, the rhetorical war, during the Pan-Arab era of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt in the 50s and 60s, that was the single most important issue that he championed. Even if it's only rhetorical, the rhetoric matters a lot. And for a variety of reasons, in the entire inter-Arab relations over the past half a century, this issue has been a unifying issue more than a dividing issue. Arabs have many differences among themselves. Mm-hmm. This is one of the few unifying issues. Now, having said this, I am not saying Arab states did not use this issue instrumentally. I am not saying that Palestinians have not been mistreated, and they have. I'm not saying
even by Arabs.
Even by Arabs, absolutely. And that various governments have exploited the Palestinian issue for their own interests, just like bin Laden is trying to exploit it. But they exploit it because it works. And in fact, if you look at the history of it, you find that it has worked for most of these states in rallying support. Nasser used it to rally support in the Arab world. It worked for him as well.
Jack Beatty, let me bring you in for a second here. This is a particularly thorny issue for the United States.
Well, it is, and especially now. But it's also an issue with some moral claim upon us. President Wilson endorsed the Balfour Declaration, but he also endorsed something else and put pressure on the British about it. And this was an agreement that the British made after the war and when they were at the Versailles Conference among Arab nations, that the phrase consent of the governed be put into the final treaty, and that the Arab territories that had been liberated by the Allies would be – their fate would be decided by the consent of the governed. Wilson insisted that go in there. And, of course, Well, it's yet to happen.
Many years later, it's yet to happen. We're talking about the central position of the Palestinians in the Arab mind, in the Middle Eastern mind, as the United States wades into its war on terrorism, a war being played out right now in the Middle East. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. Do you understand the Middle East fervor for the Palestinians? How should the United States respond? Have we done enough already? Have we not? You can join at 1-800-423-TALK. Or online at WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Palestinians and their central position in the minds of the Arab world as it looks at the West, as it looks at the new war on terrorism. We're joined this evening by Shibli Talhami. He's Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a long-standing expert in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and by our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation, too. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Can the United States respond to Arab anger over the Palestinian issue without betraying its old ally, Israel? Must we somehow do more? Jack Beatty, I want to come back to you before we pick up with Shibli Talhami again. I was really struck by the numbers that he cited from his survey of public opinion in the Middle East. 60% plus of respondents saying that the Palestinian issue was the most important issue to them personally above all other issues. These are pretty amazing numbers.
Yeah, they are, given the troubles of these regimes and the poverty of some of these countries. You know, I don't mean to be cynical, and really Professor Talhami was saying the same thing, but, you know, if the Palestinian issue didn't exist, many of these regimes would have had to invent it. I mean, it is kind of, for many of them, one senses, I don't know this, but one senses a kind of part of the politics of distraction, that instead of talking about our real troubles in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or wherever, we can talk about the Palestinian issue. But, of course, it is a real issue, and it's been, ever since the Balfour Declaration said, a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. It said something stronger, that it was going to be, Palestine was going to be the home for the Jewish people. And that ambiguity between that promise and then the other promise, which was, of course, the one I just mentioned with President Wilson in the covenant to the League of Nations, for the consent of the governed to people in the Arab world, We have yet to reconcile it.
Mm. Yeah, Shibli Talhami.
Yeah, no, I agree actually with what was said. I do think that there are a lot of problems in the Arab and Muslim worlds, economic problems, political problems that need to be addressed that are certainly on the minds of the publics and are in part the reasons for the anger and the frustration, the despair in the region, and that others have used the Palestinian issue to distract from those issues. But nonetheless, it's an important issue. It's a central issue. In the very same way, I would submit to you that the Israel issue has been a central issue in the contemporary Jewish identity. By that, I mean, it isn't that Jews only care about Israel. They don't. They care about a lot of other issues. Mm-hmm. It isn't even that they like the government of Ariel Sharon. Many of them in this country don't. It isn't that they don't blame Israel for some of the troubles in the West Bank. We know that many of them do. It isn't that they don't even support a Palestinian state. We know a majority does. So all of these things aside, they still feel that when there is a threat or a sense of threat to Israel, they're going to rally behind Israel. They support Israel because it is part of their own contemporary identity. There is that in the Arab world as well on the Palestinian issue. It doesn't translate into love for Yasser Arafat. It doesn't translate into a support for the Palestinian Authority, but it does translate into the following. I do not believe that you can have stability in the Middle East without addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's a necessary condition. It's certainly not a sufficient condition because there are, as was stated before, a lot of other problems, but it is an absolutely necessary condition before we can move forward.
Shibli Talhami, we're going to talk about that, but take us first into a kind of a meta-analysis here. What does Palestine or the Palestinians, what does it stand for in Arab consciousness? It's not exactly analogous to the Jews and Israel situation. It's not the Arab homeland. It's Palestine, after all. So what does it stand
for?
Well,
there are a number of things. One, I think it has, in a way, has been a symbol of the confrontation between the Middle East and the West, in part because of what happened after World War I when Arabs thought that they were going to have independence, and then there was the mandate, and the issue of Palestine was with the Balfour Declaration was very central in that, in part because Gamal Abdel Nasser, in his war against imperialism, which was the biggest theme in the region in the 1950s and 1960s, made this as the central issue of confrontation. So it is a symbol of the confrontation between the East and the West. In part, it is the issue of Jerusalem, which I think it is a central issue, certainly in the Islamic religion and among Muslims, even who are not religious. It's a symbolic issue. But finally, it is a sense of responsibility. It is a collective responsibility. In a way, the Arab collective consciousness is related to the failure of the Arabs to defend the Palestinians, beginning with the failure in 1948, and followed up with the 1967. And in fact, the very ascendance of Palestinian nationalism as representing an independent Palestinian entity, an independent Palestinian national movement, freed many of the Arab states into thinking individually. I believe, for example, that in 1974, when the Arab Summit Conference in Rabat, Morocco, designated the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, up until then it was the collective commitment of all Arabs to deal with Palestine. No single individual country, and not the Palestinians, had responsibility for their own affairs. They were given their own responsibility. I believe that particular move essentially freed up states like Egypt to have their own deal with Israel. And therefore, the entire process of distancing from the Palestinian issue over the past 2.5 decades has been related to the idea of establishing a Palestinian state. And we've seen, in fact, in the 1990s, after the Oslo Accords in 1993, when the Arab world thought that it's almost over, that the Palestinians have made their deal with Israel, peace is around the corner, it's just a question of time, that in fact the Palestinian issue was not so central, at least in the daily discourse in the region. And all of that crashed a year ago when those negotiations collapsed and it looked like a Palestinian state was not going to happen. And moreover, when it looked like the entire nationalist project, the PLO itself, the Palestinian Authority, may be collapsing, it looked like the conflict is being transformed into a religious and ethnic conflict, and therefore once more transferring the responsibility of the Palestinian issue back to the Muslim world and the Arab world. That's what's happening in this year in particular of violence since the collapse. You have a beginning of a transformation of the conflict from a nationalist conflict into a religious ethnic conflict, which transfers in a way the responsibility of it to a broader Arab and Muslim world.
Shibli Tilhami, you bring it up in a very compelling way. Jack Beattie?
I just wanted to ask, does it also envenom the Arab-Israeli standoff? I mean, that is to say, if you add this a religious element to what was already a nationalist element, doesn't it just make it all that much more difficult?
Absolutely.
And what is the content of the Arab idea of Palestine? Is it the West Bank, or is it from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean? In short, do people accept that Israel figures into this somehow, or is Israel just to be, well, obliterated or wished away? How does Israel figure in the Arab mind?
Good questions. The first one on the making it difficult, there's no question in my mind that if we allow this transformation to fully take place, that is, if we allow the nationalist project to collapse, we are going to be in for a period where not only we'll see more violence over the next perhaps generation, but it's hard to imagine how you can frame the conflict between Israel and the Arab and Muslim world over Palestine in ways that lend themselves to resolution. It's a scary thought because it becomes a zero-sum game. In fact, to the extent that there was ever a possibility of a peace on the issue of Palestine between Israel and the Arabs, between Israel and the Palestinians, that rested with the idea that you can have nationalist movements who will satisfy themselves by having states of their own and therefore are capable of territorial compromise. The emergence of Palestinian nationalism as a movement whose priority was to establish a state in part of Palestine, in fact, enabled the possibility of the recognition of Israel. And the and in Oslo, when Israel recognized effectively Palestinian nationalism by recognizing the PLO, it in fact also acknowledged the possibility of a two-state solution. In fact, there is no other solution that is possible in this generation that is reasonably fair and possibly stable that doesn't have a two-state component to it. And if the whole thing crashes, I think you're not going to have a possibility of a peace in this generation.
But you're saying if it doesn't crash, there's readiness to accept the Israeli state in the broader Arab world today?
I believe that the mainstream in the Palestinian community understands what it means to have two states, understand that they must accept Israel not only as Israel in secure borders, but also Israel as a Jewish state, because that's what the idea of compromise is. That is that you have two nationalities, that Israel would reflect Jewish nationalism and therefore would have a robust Jewish majority, a Palestine that would reflect Palestinian nationalism. Is this widely accepted all over the Arab world? Probably not. There are a lot of people around who don't accept that. There are a lot of people around who don't really think about it much. But by and large, the governments and the elites who have interest in seeing an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict, who in fact are facing fury in when violence goes on and the pictures on television are reporting so many Palestinian casualties without having an option. For the Arab governments. They want to see an end to it. I think you have elites in the region who bought into the idea of a two-state, and we've seen it actually after September 1993, after the Oslo Accords, that you had a normalization process that began even without having full peace.
Shibli Tilhami, we've got a long line of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let's try and turn to them. We're talking about the Palestinian issue at the center of Arab identity and maybe at the center of this war on terrorism, whether it really belongs there or not. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome.
All right. I'm a long time here. Since 62, I was born in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But and I've been a definite supporter of a two-state solution. But I always thought very cynically about all these other countries in the neighborhood supporting the Palestinians, because nobody cared when Jordan controlled the territory.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares that Syria controls Lebanon. Basically, I think the elites are mostly concerned about keeping themselves in the elite and have a great distraction next door and a great excuse for buying a lot of weapons and not doing anything for the people. Mm.
Dan, stick with us while we get an answer from Shibli Tilhami.
That actually is an interesting point. There is no question that most governments around the world, not only in the Middle East, are there to keep themselves in power. And it is true, as I said earlier, that many governments have used the Palestinian issue for their own interests. But the reason that they use it is because it works with the publics. It's very, very important for the public, and public opinion is increasingly important in the Middle East and the Arab world, in large part because of the new media, where information cannot be easily controlled. So in a way, in the Arab countries find themselves where the continuation of the Arab-Israeli conflict is a detriment to most of them. I don't want to say all of them. I'm not sure the extent to which it's a detriment to Iraq. But it certainly is a detriment to Jordan, for one thing, because Jordan's future rests, in my own judgment, with the establishment of the Palestinian state, because their existence as a Jordanian state that is separate from a state that reflects Palestinian nationalism is in part dependent on having an independent Palestinian state separate from them.
Dan, does that make you any less cynical when you get that analysis?
No, I think it's true, but I think it serves both sides. I think the Israelis would have an internal civil war between the religious and non-religious and between all of their various factions there if there wasn't this external issue to deal with, and I think the Arabs the same way. If there was actually peace, I think the Arabs, each internal nation would have a real problem because they don't have this other distraction. One other comment about the two-state solution, I think that was right at hand at Camp David. I think it fell apart because the two-state solution came to be with the concept of right of return. If Arafat had pressed for the right to compensation, I think it probably would have been feasible. I think money would have been found, and so on.
It might all have happened. But Dan, thanks very much for your call. We've got many more callers. We're going to try and get to some more right now. Arthur is on the line. Welcome, Arthur. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering what the – well, you know, it seems like this the real problem with this is to some extent that it is a symbolic conflict, and I was wondering what the what your guest thought was the minimum and that could be done and to diffuse it and to take it off the table as a point of rhetoric. And I would submit that it's not just a successful state in terms of its self-rule, but Palestinian state, but also an economically successful state, so that the Palestinians become what they were before, which was sort of somewhat disliked, as far as I know.
Around the region, yeah.
Around the region, they were considered somewhat snooty, maybe even.
Shilu Talhami, Arthur makes the point that maybe it's really a symbolic issue and a point of rhetoric, and asks what's the minimum that could be done to take it away as a point of rhetoric. Do you see it that way, and how would you respond?
Well, I don't see it as a symbolic issue, if by symbolic means you can somehow, through tactics, get it off the news. I think it is a profound issue. It really is a central issue that has to be addressed. But having said that, I want to tie it to a question you raised earlier that hasn't been answered. Does it mean that therefore the U.S. is going to have to pressure Israel? I don't think so, frankly. I don't think the issue, I think there are a lot of people who think that by virtue of making the argument that the Palestinian issue is central, and therefore the U.S. and the international community have to deal with it, therefore it translates into, therefore we have to pressure Israel, or therefore we have to reduce our commitment to Israel.
Then what does it translate into?
It doesn't translate into it. In my mind, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. First of all, it is impossible for the U.S. to impose peace on either of the parties. This is an existential issue for both Israelis and Palestinians. And frankly, even back at Camp David in 2000, the U.S. with Israel, with all the power they both had, and a very weak Arafat, a very weak Palestinian Authority, they couldn't impose a solution on him.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here quickly. Doesn't it seem to put pressure on the U.S. to do something? After all, we're in a war out there now.
Well, certainly to be engaged. I saw a piece by Shlomo Ben-Ami, a former foreign minister of Israel in the Barak government, who was saying he was really saying that they've reached a dead end. The parties there have reached a dead end, and they need the.
Jack, we're losing you a little bit again, I think.
But, you know, I'll continue his thought.
Yes, please. Okay.
I think I agree entirely. I think the U.S. should and must act to help revive the peace process. The parties right now are engaged in a cycle. They cannot free themselves from it because politically, domestically, when they go into funeral after funeral and when they have their own domestic political problems, when there is no trust whatsoever between the parties, given what transpired over the...
But you're saying it doesn't mean more U.S. pressure.
It doesn't mean that the U.S. can impose a solution. It means the U.S. is going to have to put more effort into reviving a credible peace process to bring him back to the negotiation.
Shibli Talami, we've got to take another quick break right now. We'll be right back. We're talking about the Palestinian issue, how deeply rooted it is in the Arab mind at this point, how central it may be to solving the war on terrorism. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can also read today's news from the Arab language news channel, the satellite TV channel Al Jazeera. We've translated it. It's on our website. Go to WBUR.org, click on special coverage, and you can see or read what the Arab world is reading and hearing and seeing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the Palestinians and how their cause is deep in the hearts of many in the Arab world. We're speaking tonight with Shibli Talhami. He surveyed nations across the Middle East and found that the issue of the Palestinians comes out ranking number one time after time in large majorities of Arab minds, even in Kuwait, whose who saw the Palestinians side with Saddam Hussein against them in the Gulf War. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Do you understand the Mideast fervor for the Palestinians, and how should the United States respond? Shibli Tilhami, we lost Jack for a minute there just before the break. We've got him back, but I want to be sure that we understand what you're saying about the U.S. role. You're saying the U.S. shouldn't bring more pressure to bear on Israel, and yet you seem to suggest that we should do everything we can to help solve.
What I said is the U.S. cannot impose a solution. The U.S. is going to have to nudge the parties, both parties,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
Both parties.
And the U.S. has to have an active diplomacy, and without an active American role, I don't see how they can get back to the negotiating table. So that's important. But I want to say the U.S. has a moral dilemma even aside from the tactics. The U.S. It will support Israel, Israeli security, and I believe that that's going to be continuing no matter what happens in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the U.S. cannot support the continuation of Palestinians being under occupation. The U.S. is opposed to settlement policy, and those are the issues that the U.S. is going to have to sort out for itself, the extent to which it can separate its support from the security of Israel, while not supporting Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It's a moral dilemma as well as a political dilemma. It's not just a political dilemma. There is a moral issue here because the U.S. has a moral commitment to Israeli security, but the U.S. has a moral commitment to not have the Palestinians continue under occupation. And it is this moral issue that also compels the U.S. to act even aside from the tactical questions that are obviously there.
Jack Beatty, we lost you just before the break, but this is an interesting point about the U.S. moral commitment to the Palestinians not to have them live under occupation eternally.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see former Secretary of State James Baker, say the other day that under Oslo, the settlements were not covered. That is to say, the settlements on the West Bank were to be dealt with separately. I thought that that was part of the deal, land for peace, the land including the settlements. And the Mitchell report made clear how the violence that exploded last September, really part of it, had its origin with the provocation of Ariel Sharon and other things and just the terrorism, but it also that the role the settlements played in undermining the spirit of comity that we saw even between the diplomats in the Camp David Accord. To me, that was a revelation.
Yeah, no other issue is devastating to the Palestinians than the settlements. I mean, no question that has been a major issue. On the Oslo Accords and the settlement, there was not an explicit mention of a settlement freeze specifically. There was a broader mention of not changing the status quo while mm-hmm. they negotiate. The
right.
Palestinians interpreted that as a full freeze on settlements. The Israelis didn't interpret it that way, but clearly the Mitchell report is very explicit about it, and it's explicit about what was called natural growth, that is the natural growth and expansion of existing settlements.
Shibli Tilhami, let us bring another caller. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to go back to something that Professor Tahabi said, but first, on the issue of settlements, I think you should note that at Taba, several of the Palestinian negotiators said that all the territorial issues were really settled at Taba, and the main issue, the hang-up, was the right of return. So I don't think that the territorial issues necessarily are a deal-breaker, as some people are suggesting.
Right. And your further question, Chris?
Going back to what Professor Tahabi said about Jordan benefiting from the creation of a Palestinian state. In fact, Yasser Arafat, part of his reason for not wanting to sign on in a deal that would be agreed to as final is that he has presented himself and all through before 93 and since 93 as also the representative of the Palestinian population of Jordan and the Israeli Arabs, the Palestinian population within Israel, pre-1967 Israel, that has Israeli citizenship.
Let's put that to Professor Tilhami. Thank you for your call, Chris. We just got a little time here. I want to get
Tilhami's response. First of all, Arafat certainly has seen Palestinians outside of the West Bank and Gaza as constituents, including those in Jordan and Israel. But I don't think he believed that they were his citizens. You can have you can have states have reaching out to ethnic groups outside for support, and you can work with them. But that doesn't mean you look at them as your constituents in that state. I don't think that was the problem. By the way, at Taba, the parties came very, very close to an agreement. And you're right, the issue of the right of return was one of the obstacles, but it wasn't the only obstacle. They came close, but they didn't fully agree on Jerusalem either. And both of those issues were very important to both sides. I do want to say, just to you know, for a hopeful note here, mm-hmm. in the middle of a lot of despair, they were very, very, very close to an agreement. And I believe, in fact, if they had more time, they could have reached an agreement, because it was in their interest to reach an agreement. It remains in Yasser Arafat's interest to reach an agreement, because without one, his legacy is destroyed and his militants are going to win. But if you look at the public in Israel and the Palestinian areas, even today, under these horrible conditions where there's no trust, both sides still believe, majorities in both sides believe that in a peaceful settlement through negotiations. And clearly what has happened is that the peace supporters on both sides have been on the defensive since the collapse of the Camp David negotiations. They bought into a narrative that blamed the other.
Right. Shiva Jahami, I want to bring this really up to date, and we've just got a minute left, but in the context of this war on terror, can this be won? Can terrorism be put away if this issue is not solved, given the depth of feeling about it in the Arab world?
Yes, I think it can be done without solving it. I think what happens, what you have to think about, though, is you deal with the suppliers, those who perpetrated the attacks, but you also have ultimately to reduce the anger in the region so that other terrorists wouldn't exploit it. And in order to do that, you have to have a credible process that inspires hope in the region and limits despair.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a few seconds left. Do you see that emerging?
Oh gosh, I would certainly hope so. The war on terrorism has its own infinitely complicated dynamic, and this is another infinitely complicated dynamic that seems to have been unfolded by the other war. But perhaps it'll even exercise some leverage. I've just been encouraged by the statements from the Palestinians saying, "Listen, Mr. Bin Laden, don't hijack our cause. It didn't justify anything you did." And Yasser Arafat, before this latest flurry, had actually used violence to put down an anti-American and Israeli demonstration. So we've seen in the Irish case how September 11th actually helped to catalyze a frozen process. Maybe it can happen here.
Shibli Tilhami, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Pleasure.
Shibli Tilhami is Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. His forthcoming book is entitled Identity and Foreign Policy in the Middle East. This week, anthrax claimed another victim. Americans were poised for another terrorist attack. And the World Series with those amazing Yankees went on. Now, sounds from the week that was.
A terrorist threat advisory update has been issued to 18,000 law enforcement agencies across the country. The administration views this information as credible, but unfortunately, it does not contain specific information as to the type of attack or specific targets. Consequently,
the president has expressed his condolences to the families of Mrs. Nguyen. The president is concerned about this event and this case of the fourth death by inhalation anthrax in the United States. As a result of this, the FBI, which has 7,000 agents investigating both the attack on the United States on September 11th, as well as the
focus on destroying command and control elements, whether in bunkers, tunnels, or caves. We used about 55 strike aircraft yesterday, including about 40 tactical jets off our carriers, between 4 and 6 land-based tactical aircraft, and about 8 to 10 long-range bombers.
For 2 days, high-flying D-52 bombers have carpet-bombed Taliban positions. This was the scene this morning close to Afghanistan's northern border. Raid after raid on Taliban.
Yesterday, two C-17s delivered about 34,000 food rations in the north for a total of approximately...
Yankees are absolute miracle workers. I mean, it's unbelievable. They did something that's never been done in the history of the World Series.
I'm going to refer to the threat you may be aware of against the suspension bridges in California. We believe there's a credible threat that there'll be an effort made between November 2nd and November 7th to destroy one of those bridges.
Secretary of Labor, we're discussing the new unemployment numbers, and it's not good news for America. The attacks of September the 11th have deeply affected the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Not only has it shattered the lives of those who've lost life, the attacks have threatened the livelihoods of American workers.
Sounds from the last week as the war on terror and its consequences unfold. I'm joined now by WBUR special coverage news analyst Jack Peaty. Jack, lots of icons out there this week. George Bush standing on the pitcher's mound in Yankee Stadium, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco named as a potential target, and then the images of heavy bombing from Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's been quite a week. The anthrax part of it is to me the most worrying, not just to me, but this woman who just died in New York had no contact with mail that people knew and no contact with celebrities in the media world. Dr. Matthew Methelson, the Harvard biologist, is quoted at today's Times as saying, well, maybe they've been engaged in an experiment, these terrorists. The first experiment was to see if the regular anthrax, cutaneous infection, could be transmitted through the mail. They showed it could. The second is to see whether this airborne stuff can be done through the mail. They've shown that. And he says that the third stage might be, quote, to release a heck of a lot of it somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's just a horrifying thought. If there's a kind of evolution here, a sort of experiment they're conducting.
And today also a mention of anthrax in Pakistan for the first time.
Yeah. Now, one wonders how that figures in. Apparently, that letter was mailed from Germany. We know that Germany was one of the centers of the al-Qaeda. Certainly, Mohammed Atta was there for a long time. Now, that would say, well, it isn't American right-wing fascists. It's Islamic fascists who are doing this. That would at least suggest that, since, of course, this Pakistani paper was critical of the Taliban.
Jack, the week opened with a sense, and I guess last week ended with a sense, that the war might be bogging down. Then we saw a real pickup in the pace of bombing, maybe as a response to that. And we've had guests on this show, including this evening William Crystal with the Weekly Standard, suggesting a strategy shift in the United States, saying, hey, we've got to go all out. We need progress on the war front.
Yeah, and even President Musharraf of Pakistan seemed to be accepting that logic when he was sort of saying, well, we've got to get this over with. And the only way to get it over with, presumably, is to intensify its ferocity and its effectiveness. But I've seen reports. There was a report in a London paper yesterday that the British and Americans have basically decided, well, it's got to go to ground forces next spring. And for the winter, we'll do a little bombing. We'll do a little special ops raiding. But we don't look for that to really dislodge the Taliban. That will have to come in the spring when we commit conventional forces. If that's the case, then we really are.
President Bush said again today that we shouldn't look for instant gratification in this war, and it doesn't sound like we're going to. Interesting new reports this evening, the report from New York that New York City firefighters have clashed with New York police. A dozen arrests, 5 injuries. Firefighters were chanting, bring our brothers home, and tried to push past a barricade and marched down to Ground Zero in Manhattan to protest that city's decision today to dramatically reduce the number of firefighters involved in the recovery effort. So, Jack, we've got strange developments in New York as well. There's just a lot of pressure remains around on all fronts.
Yes, there's a very strange development in New York, and it's called the New York Yankees. And for those inveterate Red Sox fans like me, it has been a real we've been cross-pressured. I mean, on the one hand, we ancestrally we want them to lose, but on the other hand, what a symbol of the sort of renaissance of New York if they can pull out these miraculous 8th and 9th and 10th inning victories. Just incredible.
Night after night. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty is senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine and special coverage news analyst with special coverage here at WBUR. For complete coverage of the war on terror or to join online conversations with other listeners, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.